This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Thank you. Well, this is my first way-seeking mind talk. Those of you who don't know what a way-seeking mind talk is, this is basically the story of my life and how I came to come to Zen. And usually you share with your Sangha so they get to know you better. You know, it's rather an intimate thing. So a lot of you newcomers are going to hear some stuff you might not always hear. So hope it won't make you uncomfortable. Okay. I'm here today because of the efforts of many sentient beings. I would not be here today if it wasn't for many key people who appeared in my life when things were not going so well. You know, my name is Michael Schnee. I'm a retired Stanford scientist. I worked in Stanford for 14 years studying hearing, how the basic mechanism of how we hear. I came to Jikoji 5 years ago. I'll get to that a little later in my story. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful every day I wake up and I'm on the side of the grass, you know, and I'm grateful to be speaking with you today. It's an honor to be sharing my life, you know, and my Sangha, because it's going to be the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know. It really is. And welcome to those on Zoom. I know Akbar, it's good to see you. I don't know there are other people. So, you know, I came from a family that was fractured. My parents actually didn't love each other. I'm remembering this as I'm going through this. You know, I mean, they loved us, but they didn't love each other. And boy, that counts. You know, kids know that. They remember it later. That's how you learn to be a person, is by watching those closest to you. You know, and so if you learn it in a twisted manner, you're going to be twisted. You know, you can't help it. It's in the human nature. So if your parents love the other parent, you know, because the kids know, they know. And it was a difficult upbringing, you know, very violent. Lots of alcoholism, and my mom was bipolar and she was untreated. So you would come home and you didn't know which parent was going to be there. The good one or the bad one. She said, hey, mom's got this mask in the closet. She brings it out sometimes, you know. I'm like, I didn't mask. But it was, they loved us too. So you see, you have the mixture of the love and the violence and the abuse. And there was abuse outside the home. So violence was a real part of my story. And so I was one angry kid, you know, who learned to self-medicate at a very young age. You know, I discovered alcohol and drugs at 15. And they were a big part of my, you know, I need to talk about that because that's who I am. They were a big part of my life until I was 33. So recovery is like 37 years of my life. And I don't see how I can tell my story without bringing that in. I hope it doesn't offend anyone. So I knew suffering, you know. And I medicated first with cigarettes, then with drugs, and then with alcohol. But I was a highly successful guy, you know, in a lot of respects. But I didn't get to where I was without a lot of key people in my life. First was my grandmother, who I get emotional. But that's the one person who gives you unconditional love in your life. You know, you won't get that again. You get that once. And I got it from her. And that enables you to survive until the next person comes along. You know, and that was my first grade teacher, who used to keep me after school because she knew what kind of home I came from. And she would have me read to her. And I was like, how come I always got to stay here and read? You know, the other kids get to go home. You know, I didn't understand at the time what a gift that lady was giving me. You know, and there was Doc. He was a Boy Scout leader. You know, my father was a Boy Scout leader too. And, you know, he didn't know how to deal with this angry kid. But Doc took me aside, you know, like they were going to kick me out of the summer camp. And Doc would take me. He says, look, you know, you're going to work in a kitchen. You're going to get up at 4:30. You're going to stock the stoves with the wood, and you're going to make breakfast. And it's like, wow, for a fox, don't throw me in the fire patch. I love that, man. I get up in the morning, I make the breakfast, these giant pots of milk and pancakes and scrambled eggs. And I got to do that by myself because I just could not relate to people, you know, and just would get in fights. I'd be an instigator. I would pick a fight if somebody wasn't fighting. But I didn't know how to behave. You know, I really didn't. And this guy, you know, if he had come along, I don't wonder what happened, you know. And throughout my life, there's been these people. It's been these people. I did not get to where I am today because of my efforts completely. There was always someone in my life, always someone who stepped up when it needed to be stepped up, or otherwise I wouldn't be here, you know. I was kicked out of school in the ninth grade, selling drugs and doing, you know, various different things. And it was this teacher who specialized in kids like me. Every Saturday, you come around, beep the horn, and you got in a car with him with all these other misfit kids. And you would know, what are you doing here? You know, you knew these kids, but you don't want to be part of it. But he would take us to do things, you know. He would take us to ball games. He would just hang out with us. He would just let us be who we were so that, you know, take a day off the streets, you know. And, you know, I don't know what happened to these teachers. But I'm eternally grateful for them, you know. And then it was, as I got older, you know, I was just roaming up and down the country on hitchhiking, doing drugs, you know, somewhat recreationally, working when I needed to. But there was this family, three young people who brought me into their family. You know, it was actually two brothers and a woman. It was a very odd family because it was Billy and Dwayne and Marianne. And Marianne had been married to Billy, but now she was with Dwayne, his brother. So I thought that was perfectly normal, you know? So I moved in with them and roamed around the country with them. We lived in the woods in Florida for a winter. You know, we hunted and fished, and people left us alone. They knew we were back there. And they saved me from, you know, they, like Dwayne, I met when I started working at this gas station at 15, he said, you know, he just took me in because you see the guys I was running with, who, you know, there's a bad end. A lot of them are dead now, dead or in jail or institutionalized, you know, which is where I could have been, even though, you know, I had a good family. My father was a school teacher. My mom tried to do her best she could, but, you know, she was crippled. So I'm really saying this because, you know, I don't think any of us get to where we are by ourselves, but I can say that, you know, these people were key to my life, and I really need to acknowledge their existence wherever they are. If they're listening to me by some strange quirk, if they're dead, I have to, this keeps me grateful. You know, this keeps me humble. And then my older brother took me in for a while, let me live with him and his wife. And, you know I was a handful. I know it was difficult. It was, you know, it was compassion. And that's why I'm here today. And then another person who came along was, you know, instrumental in my life was my first wife. And she was a caretaker. She saw me as her project. And she saw, these people saw something in me that I never saw in myself. For a long time, I never saw that. It took a lot of things that I'll talk about for me able to see who I was. I had no clue who I was, but she saw something in me. And she was a college student. I was living in Newark, Delaware, a college town. I met her. I met her at a party. Yeah, that's right. I met her at a party, and she, you know, it was like this instant kind of chemistry thing. And a few months later, we were living together, and then she says, "You got to get a job. You know, you got to get a driver's license, number one." She started driving me around. I was 20 years old and hadn't driven a car. Well, I had driven some cars and wrecked them, but I didn't really know how to drive. And I remember she was really mad. She had a Volkswagen Bug, and she pulls on this hill, pulls the emergency brake. It's a clutch, you know, and she says, "Get in the car, you're driving." Oh, that's how I learned how to drive, you know. And I got jobs. You know, and then she got pregnant with my daughter, Mariah, who's now 47. Then I really cleaned my act up. You know, I went to, they had special programs for people like me who had dropped out at early ages of college. So I took the GED, and because, you know, her example was she was a college student, and I realized that I was as smart as she was. And she encouraged me. I got my GED. I went to the college, and they said, well, if you take these three or four courses this summer and pass, you know, get B or better, you can go to college. And so I did. We, you know, we were very poor. We had a kid on the way. And so Johnson was president, had this program, the Great America Program. He gave me money to go to school and bought my books, paid my tuition, gave me a bus and lunch. And I went to college. And, you know, that doesn't happen today. It's gone. But I'm eternally grateful for that. Unfortunately, the alcoholism did end that marriage. You know, it damaged that marriage and damaged my daughter. And so she threw me out. But that was the beginning of my recovery. I got sober after that. You know, I got sober when she threw me out. But that was the end of that marriage. And luckily, I mean, in a way, I mean, my daughter and I didn't have a great relationship when she was 11. This is when we divorced and I got sober. And so I spent every weekend with her until she was, you know, 18, you know, and it made a big difference because she would say, like, she was young, a kid, you wouldn't believe it, 4 or 5. So I'm going fishing today on Saturday after work, you know, and she says, no, you're not, Dad, you're going drinking. I'm like, holy shit. And, you know, I was a successful guy. I was a scientist at DuPont, you know. I had my own lab. I was the first scientist they ever hired on the master's level, was given half a lab. So I had this huge, successful part of my life. But I had this other part that was just completely dysfunctional from upbringing and from the family history of alcohol and drugs, you know. But even the birth of my daughter and the didn't stop that. It took a lot more than that. But I hit that bottom and I recovered. What are we doing on time? And so I met my second wife, who was also critical. And at that point, I was just getting sober and met her, and she was much more experienced in the program. And we became a couple in recovery. And that was critical to my recovery of 30 some years. And unfortunately that marriage is ending. I'm living it here now. And that's also very traumatic. Yeah. Sorry about that. I told you this is gonna be a tricky business, you know. It's hard to talk about your life some parts, you know. But that's why Zen is here. That's why we'll get to that in a minute. Why this Zen saved my life another time. You know? Because I have always been searching. I mean, I was never religious. I never believed in God, but I knew there had to be something better than what there is. You know, there's got to be a better way. You know, and you know, the 12 step is based a lot on Buddhist principles. So there was that. And so I did get kind of find through that. But, you know, they ask you to believe in a power greater than yourself. And I just could not figure that out. And I came to believe that the people in the meetings and the people in the zendos are powers. So, you know, I still hadn't discovered Zen, although, you know, I was thinking about this. I grew up in the Vietnam era, you know. My brother, he got high school and he was number 7 in the lottery. So he was going to Vietnam in the infantry. So he went to college. And I was 17. And my father said to me, he says, you're not going to draft. You just don't register because you're not going to college. But don't register. Just go to Florida for a while. Go back up to Pennsylvania. Do not register for the draft. So I didn't. And then later, Carter had that amnesty program for people who dodged the draft, you know. Otherwise, with my problems going into that mess, coming out, I had too many friends who came back junkies, you know, or dead. And we actually saw that on TV. We saw my neighbor across the street, Jimmy Garrison, we're watching TV and somebody yells, "That's Jimmy Garrison." And he was on a tank. He was stretched out. He had got shot in the leg or something. And now everybody said, "Bullshit." Like 2 months later, he's home on crutches. It was him. So they learned real quick not to televise the war on a TV, because every day you watched the war and you saw people you knew. You know, they learned really quick not to put it on the TV anymore. But that's a side part. But I met Jenny, my second wife, and we were together 36 years. And we moved to New Orleans and lived there for 6 wonderful years. Man, I had a life there that was great. And then Katrina came. Took everything. You know. Get this stuff hard to talk about. You know, sometimes. Even though it's been all those years. You know, it was 2005, August 2005, we survived the hurricane. And I'm watching this TV, and they said the levees broke. Water came through. If I learned impermanence there, that was a big lesson in permanence. That's like, you don't just lose, okay, your house burns down, you still got your neighborhood, right? Still got your next door neighbors. But when Katrina came, it took everything. It took 80 people in my neighborhood died. It took my coffee shop where I went every day after work. It took my grocery store. It took my way of life. You know, it took the entire neighborhood out. And you didn't know back then, the cell phone towers are down. You didn't know who survived and who didn't out of the lab. We didn't get any contact for 6 weeks or more. So every day you'd go to bulletin boards that the Red Cross would put up and look for names. Yeah, you know? But it was exhilarating too. It was a really exhilarating part, like sneaking back into my neighborhood in a city that's closed with my best friend, and we got a truck because we had gotten a picture. Blindly, I could see that my second story was out of water, so I said, "We're going down there." You know, we got down there as soon as the water was out. We snuck in the city and we rescued my wife's art studio. She was a painter. And then we got stuff out of my house that had been looted by looters twice. But, you know, that was a real lesson in impermanence. I think it set me up for some of Buddhism. What else set me up for some of Buddhism was on the wall of my growing up, I had 2 pictures. Oh, I had a lot of Life magazine pictures, tons of them. And I had 2 in particular. One was Thich Nhat Hanh's monk who set himself on fire and sat zazen as he burned and didn't move. The other one was the girl running down the street all burned by napalm. Now here you got 2 pictures of the same thing, people being burned. This guy sitting zazen without moving. This girl's, of course, covered with napalm. Her clothes were burned off and she's screaming bloody murder going down the street. So you got the 2 things going on and you got the same response. But I carry that image, and I still carry that image of that monk. I just don't know how that's possible, that you have the mental toughness and the love for this world that you could set yourself on fire like that. That just, you know, so I used to say I didn't know anything about Zen before I came here, but I did know subconsciously. I had that picture in my mind, and I still have that picture, and I still... blows my mind that someone can do that. And that's the power of this of Zen. You know, he did it. And Buddhism. You know, that changed the war. Those 2 pictures helped change the war, helped end the war, I think. So that was a sacrifice worth making. Could I ever do something like that? I'd say no, but I don't know. You know, that's not in my experience yet. I haven't been put into that situation. We don't know. You know, we don't know. So survived Katrina, did a ton of work. You know, there's a whole big story there, but I ended up in California. You know, my job came to California. I did not want to come to California. I didn't like California. I wanted to stay in New Orleans, but my job came here and my neighborhood was gone. We were being lied to by the government. We didn't get any money to rebuild like they said. You know, it was just lie after lie after lie. And so I said, the hell with it, I'm leaving. She was sick. My wife was sick. I said, "We're getting out of here. We're leaving. We're going somewhere else. You know, we're going to start over." And I don't know, maybe I should have stuck it out. In retrospect, you know, maybe I should have. My wife didn't do well in that move. I mean, you know, she's like one of these orchids. You just can't move them. I mean, you just can't take them out of where they are. I think I damaged her. But Stanford, you know, the ego, my big ego wanted this job. You know, look at me. I was kicked out of school. I grew up on the streets, kind of, and I'm at Stanford. Are you kidding me? I didn't hear her complaints. I didn't hear her say, please don't do this. I just did what I wanted to do when I came to Stanford. And it was at Stanford that I finally, after what's this, 30 minutes of getting to Zen, a student in my lab brought me here. She was a bit, this wasn't really a chatterbox, but you know, a typical young person talking all the time and da da da. And she said, well, I just did the whole week silent. And I'm like, oh, bullshit. You didn't do a week silent. I don't believe you. And so we came here. She brought me to Coach, she had been here, and we dropped in on a nature machine, and she said, oh, I said, how long is this going? You know, and she says, 40 minutes. And I'm like, all right, you know, and then she said, it's time to go. I said, what'd I do wrong? Did I do something? Why are we leaving? She said, it's over. I said, what are you talking about? And it went 40 minutes, went like that, with just like snapping your fingers. I have had that a few times, but not many. That experience of time going like that, you know. But then I was thinking a year later about that. My father had died in 2014, right before I came here. No, I was already here. I was already here. It's 2014 he died. And I went and sat with him. They called me. You get the call, you know. He had been in assisted living, and he was slowly getting dementia from a series of strokes, and he got pneumonia. He had been telling me, you know, look, Mike, you know, can't you just, like, smother me? Why? You know, he'd be in what he was. And I'm like, no, I can't do that, Pop. But I was called to the hospital, and I sat with him, and I brought books, and I brought work, because, you know, I'm going to be sitting there, and you know what? And touch paper. I didn't touch a book. I didn't turn the TV on. I didn't pick up anything. And I sat with him for 5 or 6 days as he died. And I breathed with him. And I just sat there out of time. I don't, you know, it was just like that Zazen period. I would sit there. My wife would call me. And, you know, at the end of the day, and, you know, she said, you were somewhere else. The other kids would come and go. They didn't like, they'd stay for a little while, you know. But I stayed and I stayed and I stayed. And I don't understand that period, but it was kind of out of time kind of thing. It was a huge gift. It was like one of the best things I've ever done, is sitting with him as he died. And at one point, you know, he'd come to sometimes. At one point, you know, he kind of woke up and I said, hey, Pops, you know who I am? And he's kind of looking and he says, yeah, you're one of my sons. And that was cool. You know, and then I was so angry that I missed, you know. I went home one night, it was like midnight. The nurse says, you should go to sleep because, you know, he's not going tonight, but he did. In the morning, wasn't there. But she said, they won't let go when you're sitting there. They'll keep, you're keeping them here. You got to go. And I miss him like crazy, you know, still. It's funny. With all the chaos and everything, you know, I terribly miss him. But that set me up for Zen. You know, that set me up for Zazen. That experience of sitting with him, I think, and that's why the Zazen felt so familiar when I sat, and it went so quickly. And really, you know, this part of Zen is I get everything emotionally. You know, my intellect, if it's in the intellect, it's just, it has to get down to my heart for me to absorb it. And I think that's what was then. I didn't think about it too much, you know, about like, didn't understand the Heart Sutra. I didn't understand like what you all do in here with these chants and stuff I do now. But I mean, I love sitting on that cushion. I love this being able to finally sit still and just get a rest from my damn mind. You know, that is such a gift to be able to sit in this cushion and get a rest from your mind for a few minutes. It enabled me to, Zazen had enabled me to slow down, to become less impulsive. I was a smart ass. If you said something, I had a back, and it cost me so much trouble in my life. I don't do that anymore, or as much. It made me become less reactive. You know, I actually jumped into Zen in this Jokoji life here, like I did in AA. You know, that's the only way I got it. I jumped in the deep end. That's what I learned to swim. My brother threw me in the deep end. You know, you're going to swim or you're going to drown. And the same thing with AA. You're either going to stop or you're going to die. And I came into Zen and I just jumped into it. I didn't question it. I didn't say, oh, this is bullshit. I ignored a lot of the stuff, you know, that, and I just sat. And it made a huge difference in my life, you know. I attended every Zazen Kai that they had here for 2 years. And that was back when you would come, it was 6 in the morning, and I'd get up at 4:30 and drive where I was living in Pacifica down here. And sit, and we made our own lunch, and you know, listen to Dharma talk, and you got to talk to the teachers. And I'm so grateful for Doug Jacobson. He was my teacher still is, for many, many, many long talks after Zazen Kai. Many were book clubs. We have a Thursday night book club where I'd get up early, would make supper together. And we would talk about my life, you know, and I would just like give me, oh, this lab is so hard. You know, I had 12 students, right? 10 of them were women and 2 were men. And I had a boss who didn't like women. And so I was this buffer between all these people and my boss. And it was killing me. It was killing me because due to my upbringing, I didn't understand boundaries. I didn't know you could say no. You know, I did what was asked. And one of those students, of course, was Yan Li Wang, who brought me here. And what was really cool was she came and taught here on Saturday, the Eco Buddhist thing. So it's like full circle. She brings me here, and I invite her back 5 years later. You know, that Saturday was so special to me to see how much she's grown. And, you know, she's always been ahead of me on the path, you know, and she's still up there. I can see her in the distance, you know, I'm way behind her. And that was a huge blessing of coming to Jokoji, you know, for introducing me to this place and being such a huge part of my life. She said she didn't want to be here today, but I guess she didn't. But you know, I lived here off and on for weeks. You know, my home life has slowly been deteriorating. My relationship with my wife is not good, and now it's real not good. And we'll come here, live for 3 weeks at a time, go to work, and go home. And talking with Doug, sitting on the cushion, helped me decide to retire, to finally leave this job that was just killing me, you know. So I retired 3 years ago. But it was through talking to teachers and through coming to Zen that I could come to this decision, that I could actually sit still. You know, when you just have a problem and you don't know how to meditate, the problem just spins in your head, or in my head, and just spins and it just spins, and you really don't see it. Here you start to see your thoughts. If you sit long enough, you start to see them. And it's like the uncertainty principle. Once you see it, it changes. The thought loses its power once you can identify it. It's going to come back, but it's not going to be as powerful, you know? And so I get the same old shit that comes up. I mean, the balance done to me was bad because I couldn't stand to be touched until I was a late teenager. I mean, I really could not stand. It was painful for people to touch me. I didn't know why my body. The body remembers. The mind can say, it's fine. They're not going to hit you, but the body remembers. And it just like, so that really affected intimacy, of course. You don't like being touched much. And kids thought it was funny, you know, growing up. Now let's go touch Mike, you know, and I'd be running. I would like want to touch me, right? I mean, how insane is that, right? You know, I've dealt with this stuff on the cushions. I've dealt with, you know, why was I so angry and still so angry sometimes? Why am I so bullying? Why am I so hard to get along with? And it all comes back down to these early things, which you bring up and they start losing their power. I will always flinch probably, but I'll know that recovery is so much faster. You know, I won't, you know, it's the body remembers, it's just nothing you can do about it. It's part of your wiring now. But I wouldn't have got through this without coming to the Zendo. I would just would not have got through these things. So then I moved to Oregon. I retired. I couldn't afford to live here anymore, so I had to move to Oregon. And again, I should not have taken my wife out of California. That was a mistake. That was a huge mistake. She hates Oregon, but she's up there now and I'm down here. And the plan is they can move her back to her old neighborhoods and I could live here and afford to pay that kind of rent. But that's my plan. It's my idea. I'm living here now. And this is I had to leave. I had to. Sometimes you just have to do things. That's what I got to say about that. It's ongoing, it's difficult, it's traumatic. But I'm here, and what is life like at Jacoji? It was a dream to always live here. Ever since I came here, I thought I romanticized this place. I romanticized the lifestyle. And, I thought this would be the greatest thing in the world to live here, and it is the greatest thing in the world to live here. And it's the hardest thing in the world to live here. I haven't lived with anyone except two wives for like 30, 40 years. And coming in and living with a group of people you don't know all that well, that's a real difficult thing. Community life is difficult. And I'm learning a lot. Also it can be exhilarating. Like yesterday we had a work period and we had the eco chaplains, my former student leading. That was just so wonderful. And we had all these young people who were building this path down through the woods. And just having this activity and being able to cook for them and be able to just see that. That was priceless, That was priceless. And I've had so many of these priceless moments here. When I retired, I had three students I was close to, so I cooked them a dinner and we spent the afternoon at Chakochi, And that's one of those memories that you keep, this, we're all, I'm going different ways, they're going different ways. I'm not going to have this again. It's going to be this one moment. And I did. I lived that one moment, that one evening with these people, and it was so wonderful. It was so wonderful, And I wouldn't have had that if I hadn't been here. There's just so many of these kind of memories here that now I'm living here. I mean, living here, you all get to come on a Sunday and get to sit, and you have a clean zendo. You have food prepared. If you're staying, you've got a nice room. Someone has to do that work. I never really thought of that too much. It's a lot of work keep us up, man. We don't get paid. We're doing this as service. Well, maybe someone's get paid. I don't get paid. So I got up this morning at 6 o'clock, 6:30. I tried doing Jerome's job, started doing vacuuming. But you clean up, you get ready for you get ready for the influx of 30 or 40 people or 20 or whatever it is. And you don't resent it. I mean, it's part of being a resident and part of being and part of Zen. Zen isn't always just sitting on a cushion. You carry it over into your, I carry it into my cooking. I carry it into my art. I carry it into my gardening. I carry it everywhere I go. And there are moments where I can be doing something like digging a garden for 3 hours. And that's what I'm doing is digging a garden and not thinking about anything. And at the end of it, it's like, damn, that was just like Zazen. That was because we're taking a shower, that the relief from the mind is it's just wonderful. And that's what I've been getting. And I get it here, and given the service. You can't keep it unless you give it away, as we say in the 12 step. If you like you can't keep it unless you give it away. It means passing on what was freely given to me. And I wanted when I first came here, I thought the separation would be temporary. So I wanted to get fix all the things that bug me in this place. You know, here's my ego. I'm going to come at Jacoji and I'm going to fix the things that bug me. And in my mind, I think that's like perfectly good. I didn't think about the people living here. What do they want? You know, I want to come in and fix this. I want to. And Emily is coming, going to be a resident here, did it first. She painted the kitchen. So I took her lead and I painted the community room and fixed it up. And then I went and painted the resident room and fixed it up. And then I did the men's bathroom because these things bothered me. But I didn't say that, like, Drew, hey, you mind if I paint the kitchen? I just went and painted the kitchen. My big ego, you know. But we worked through it. But I want to bring in new people. I want young people to come here and feel all the joy that I felt here. I want people. This is a place for difficult people, I think. That's what Doug told me once. It is. It's like a rock tumbler. You get all these nice crunchy rocks and you put them in this tumbler, you know, which is Jacoji, and it starts tumbling. And eventually, if you stay around, you get smoother. And eventually you'll have some nice pretty rocks, you know. But it takes time and it takes effort. And this place has to be here to do that. It has to exist. It has to. So I have to give back to this community what was so freely given to me. I really feel that so strongly. I mean, I may end up leaving. I don't know how long I'll be here, but I have to give back. If I don't give back, then what's my life worth, you know? I honestly feel that, you know, strongly, and I have been giving back. So now I'm like, yeah, I got to slow down. I'm going to be here longer. I got to slow the work down, you know, slow down what I'm doing, take better care of myself, evaluate, you know, my impact on these other people, you know, and my impact on myself. Some of the biggest work I did on the cushion was being able to forgive my mother and actually being able to, in our 12 steps, we make amends for the wrongs we have done. And I did it twice to my mother, but it wasn't real. It took the third time to go with, she was assisted living. It was COVID, so you couldn't go in. So I sat outside on the phone for a whole week. Talked to her until she got too tired to talk. You know, and I did that for a week. I wanted to say goodbye. We knew we'd never see each other again. She died in March. I went in October and she died that March. Very peaceably, very full of faculties. But we had that moment. And we were able to talk and was able to understand more of her life. I mean, my grandfather had polio when he was 30. So it took the muscles of his abdomen. So he couldn't walk at first. He had to learn to walk again. Well, in the 30s, you don't work, you don't eat, you know, there's no safety net. So the family got split up and my mom and my grandmother, my mom and her mother, my grandmother went and lived in a poor house and cleaned and cooked in the poor house until my grandfather could walk. So I began to understand the difficulties she had growing up, which she could not deal with, except take them out on us, you know, as kids. But hearing all this and being able to hear these stories and being able to actually meet with her where she was, you know, where she was huge. And to actually be able to, in my heart, completely forgive her before she died, which was huge. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to go down there. You know, if I hadn't done it, what a mistake, huh? What a thing to live with. But I learned that about myself by practicing Zazen. I can't tell you what emptiness is very well, probably. I do know codependent arising. You know, I do know that one. You know, there's a lot of stuff I just don't get. You know, when people start talking about Dogen says this and Dogen says that, my mind starts going to sleep a lot, you know? I'm like really practical as my Zen. I'm like Joko Beck. If anyone's ever read Every Day Zen, we did that as a book club here. I led it. It was wonderful. I highly recommend it to new people. It's like Zen that's practical. You know, I don't know what enlightenment is. You know, I don't know. I don't understand it. I don't have any experience of it. I don't know what it is. I know it's like losing all attachments and not having desires. But I don't really know. But I do know that I'm a better person sitting on a cushion. I'm easier to be around. I do know doing service makes the world better. Maybe this is what they mean when they say, you know, what is it? We'll save all beings, you know. I didn't understand that for a long time, but I understand now that, like, I ranted about these homeless people invading my town in Medford. It's terrible, you know, but I ended up sponsoring one of these homeless guys and working with them for a year, you know, so that's saving all beings. You know, that's saving, you know, and providing a place like this, helping to provide, that's saving all beings. I'm beginning to get a practical understanding of what it is. But okay, 12:23. Let me end with some artwork. Talk about my artwork a little bit. Since I came to Jokoji, I brought some artwork down. It's a fundraiser. But talk briefly about paths. I'm a photographer and I do mixed media, but I took a series on the ridge. If you're familiar with Jokoji, you know the ridge. Everyone goes to the ridge, meditates. This is, and there's all these paths up on the ridge, you know. So this whole series of photographs are up on the wall. The community are about paths, the paths we take, the paths we don't take. Or we make our own path. You know, what does a path mean to you? Like this, Chuck Holcroft is his last name, I think. And a student doing Dokusan up on the ridge last year during Rohatsu, you know. So they're on their path and they're talking. And
maybe the Zoom people will see.
What's that? Oh, yeah. Can you see that? Oh, no. Now you can see it. Ah, sorry. It's the reflection's probably in the way. But then there's a second one, which is two paths, okay? Now, let's get this right. Yeah. Here we have two paths. Which one are you going to take? Or do they come back together as one path? You know? And so it's a meditation on paths, you know, or however you want to do them. And I did them in black and white because I wanted the form to come out, you know. I wanted it to be a little more abstract, and black and white abstracts a scene. And so you can talk about the emotional content of the picture or the form.
Right.
Partly as a reaction, now photography's become with AI and with Photoshop, you can make anything you want. You don't even have to have a camera. You can make it so it's like, how can I express myself better? So I started doing these mixed media pictures. This is, if you look outside of the Zendo, you'll see the Buddha head. This is the Buddha head. I took a picture of the Buddha head. I printed it on Japanese handmade paper, right? And I glued it onto a gesso board. And on this board, I used a blue color in the background. So, oops, sorry, guys. You can't see, can you? Now you can see him. And some of these are on the website. Oh, hey, Rachel, I see you. I glued it onto this gesso board so the blue came out. Paper's very thin, very translucent. So when you glue it down with acrylic medium, you can see the background. And then I start putting wax on it. And then I start taking oil colors and pencil and different things. And I keep waxing and making more layers. And I put these oriental poppies from my garden and press them and put them on it. You're getting this multimedia thing. And this is, what did I call this? Flowering Buddha. This is the Flowering Buddha. You know, and I've done a whole series on Jokoji, you know, here with my art. Well, I guess it's almost time for lunch. I think I've talked this long. Sorry to bore you guys. I want to read a poem by Mary Oliver that really speaks to me about the journey. This is called The Journey. This, you know, really speaks to me. One day you finally know what you had to do and began. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice through the whole house. Their bad advice through the whole house began to tremble, and you felt the old tug at your ankles. Mend my life, each voice cried, but you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations. Though their melancholy was terrible, it was already late enough in a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice which you surely recognized as your own, and that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. And yeah, that does a lot what's going on with me today. I guess I'll finish. I don't, well, you heard the grass. I guess I'll finish with that. That'll be the end. Because this sutra speaks to me. This sutra speaks to me. This, I could call this Jokoji, you know, instead of the song of the grass hut hermitage. I build a grass hut where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and I enjoy a nap. When it was completed, fresh weeds appear. Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. The person in the hut lives there calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Places worldly people live, she he doesn't live. Realms worldly people love, she he doesn't love. This speaks to me about being here in Jokoji. You know, although the hut is small, like this room, it includes the entire world. In 10 square feet, an old man illumines forms and their nature. You know, old man, a great vehicle, bodhisattva, trust without doubt. The middling or lowly can't help wondering, will his hut perish or not? Perishable or not, the original master is present, not dwelling south or north, east or west, firmly based on steadiness, it can't be surpassed. A shining window below the great green pines, jade palaces or vermilion towers can't compare with it. Just sitting with head covered, all things are at rest. Thus this mountain monk doesn't understand at all. Living here, he no longer works to get free. Who would proudly arrange seats trying to entice guests? Turn around the light to shine within, then just return. The vast, inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. Meet the ancestral teachers. Be familiar with their instruction. Find grasses to build a hut and don't give up. Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk innocent. Thousands of words, myriad interpretations are only to free you from obstructions. If you want to know the underlying person in the hut, do not separate from the skin bag here and now. And that to me is just like Zen. This is just describes Zen to a T for me and living in Jokoji. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.